Thank you very much for joining us this morning, lunchtime. As you know, we're here to use the opportunity for a launch event for the book that John Altman and Chaim Malka have just published here at CSIS, Arab Reform and Foreign Aid, The Lessons from Morocco. I just want to say a word or two by means of introduction before handing over to John and Chaim to talk about the book and its conclusions and engage in a discussion with all of you here. The opening kind of comment I wanted to make was just to give you a sense of the genesis of this book and some of the thinking about why we, CSIS, became involved. The book really is the end product of a one-year project that John and I thought up, that we notionally titled the U.S., the EU, and Middle East Reform, What Are the Lessons That We Can Learn from Morocco? And our thinking behind this project was driven a lot by the launch of the Broader Middle East and North Africa Initiative at the Sea Island G8 Summit back in 2004. As we all know, a highly ambitious initiative, and one that wasn't just driven by, I think, the general desire to support and promote reform in that broad region, but also the need to do so. And the need to do so not only after 9/11, but the kind of spread of radical Islam, some of the terrorist attacks that took place in North Africa, the instability, obviously, in the Middle East as a whole, but also the way that some of this instability had moved into Europe in particular. As the U.S. and the EU were key instigators of the Bamina initiative, we were kind of challenged to think, what does each side bring? It might have been a joint project, a pretty difficult one in terms of gestation and launch, but what it did remind us about is the kind of different historical connections, the different geographical priorities, the different economic linkages, the different styles of reform promotion and foreign assistance that the U.S. and the EU bring to this part of the world and to these initiatives as a whole. And we thought that the good idea would be to look at one test case, in particular to look at Morocco. And why Morocco? Three fairly self-evident reasons. The first is that Morocco had already launched itself on a path of reform, as all of you know better than I do. First of all, under King Hassan II, and then now continued under King Mohammed VI, parliamentary reform, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, important steps taken in women and family rights, and also in decentralization of political power. But secondly, as you also well know, the job is just getting started. A huge amount of work needs to be done in economic reform, in poverty alleviation, stratification, radicalization, political inclusion. The third reason we thought it would be interesting to undertake the project is because, in a way, the U.S. and the EU have both made Morocco a priority. The EU Free Trade Agreement, its association agreement, now extended through into Morocco being one of the key countries in the European Union's European neighborhood policy, and the U.S. having concluded its free trade agreement, but also made Morocco a candidate for Millennium Challenge Corporation funding. So basically what we did is we, in terms of both programs, we were involved in undertaking some research at the outset, but then we benefited in particular from a week-long trip that we undertook to Morocco that the Middle East program in particular put together that involved scholars and experts not only in Middle East reform but also in democratization from the Europe program, from Europe and from the United States. And that book led to a trip report, and then John and Chaim really dug down and got into the key conclusions and produced what I think is this very valuable and interesting book, because in a way it's doing something different from what other books have done in the kind of challenge that it's set itself of looking at the comparative approaches to supporting reform in the country. I want to thank a few people. That's many. I think my main job here is to thank people. I want to thank two people I don't see here, but Natalia Filipiak and Jason Gluck in the Europe and Middle East programs, respectively, who did quite a bit of the background research for the book. And Michael Boltz, a colleague of ours, who helped us run the trip that we did out to Morocco. I want to thank the German Marshall Fund and also the Moroccan American Cultural Center, who each provided the launch funding and the funding for us to be able to undertake this project. And in particular, thank Ambassador Gabriel for the support he gave us on the trip out there. And finally, I'd like to thank CMS Energy, who've been able to give us wherewithal to lay on this nice lunch and not just a paper coffee event, paper cups and coffee event for the launch of the book. In any case, I don't need to do more in terms of introducing John and Chaim. Their bios are both in the book, and I think they're known to all of you here. But I want to thank also John and Chaim for being great colleagues, for putting together, I think, what is a great product. We look forward to discussion. Thanks for coming today. And over to you, John.
Thanks, Robin. I agree that there are many people that actually contributed to this report, and it goes well beyond John and myself. Robin was a fantastic colleague and a great partner to travel with in Morocco. And as far as projects go, I can't imagine a greater country to visit and study than Morocco. And you were there too, John, so that was a lot of fun. But one of the things that strikes me about Morocco is the diversity of Morocco. The geography is diverse, the people are diverse, the languages are diverse, the cultural influences are incredibly diverse. It's an Arab country, it's Muslim, it has Spanish Andalusian influences, it's Berber, it's African, it's European, it's all these things together, but at the same time, there's a sense of Moroccan-ness that Moroccans feel. And I think this diversity, which I picked up in Morocco, very much characterizes for me the debate over political reform in Morocco. It's an extremely diverse set of issues and ideas about political reform. Anyone you ask, everyone you ask will give you a different answer about what political reform means. There are so many different groups, so many different ideas, and I think reform means something different to everyone. But at the same time, there's a broad consensus within Morocco that change is necessary, that reforms are necessary. And where people differ really is on several main issues, one of them being the pace of reform. But this debate, which is positive, and the diversity of views also creates tension and challenges among the different actors in society and political forces that are promoting reform. It has led to a balancing act, really, and the king has so far been a very effective manager of this reform process. And there's a lot of debate about his role as well, as a monarch, as a top-down reformer. And again, the debate and the diversity, I think, goes to all levels of political reform, including the role of the international donor community in Morocco and what their role should be. Again, the U.S. and Europe are taking the lead on this strategy of political reform in the region. There's a broad consensus that change is necessary, that change is desperately needed in the region, including Morocco, but they both have different strategies and different ideas of how to promote this reform, as Robin alluded to. So I think the main challenge for Morocco and the international community working together is that to ensure that this diversity of views and the debate over political reform evolve in parallel with each other and with positive reforms, which can lead to a politically inclusive and secure Morocco where individual rights are guaranteed for all citizens. So these are sort of the basic ideas that we launched this program, this project, as Robin mentioned earlier. We had three main objectives in this project. One was to examine Morocco's reform process more broadly. The other was to assess European and American strategies for promoting reform in the Middle East in general and Morocco more specifically. And third is to identify opportunities for transatlantic consensus in promoting reform. So I'll just give you a little bit of background before I get into the details of some of the debates that Morocco is dealing with. In January, the Middle East program and the Europe program led a group of 10 American and European experts from think tanks, other policy organizations, to Morocco. We met with over 150 different people from all walks of life. We met with regime supporters, government officials, local elected officials, and we also met with people who were vehemently trying to overthrow the monarchy and the system of government in place in Morocco, such as Islamists, which remain outside of the political system. We met with students, we met with business leaders, we met with so many different people, and this is where we really got this flavor for the debate and the diversity of the ideas that characterize Morocco's reform process. And I think Morocco is an ideal test case to look at these issues because there is already an active debate in Morocco, because there is a regime commitment. The king has made a decision to promote change, to promote political and economic reform. And again, there's active U.S. and EU engagement. So these three conditions made Morocco an ideal candidate to examine the issue of political reform more broadly in the Arab world. I'll just go through some of these points. I think the debate also highlights the complexity, though. With so many competing ideas, there inevitably is tension in the system. There is tension between these ideas, and there is competition. And I think this is a key challenge that Morocco has to face. One of the key debates, as I mentioned earlier, was the pace of reform. There's a sense of urgency and race against the clock. Morocco is facing significant socioeconomic issues, as we all know about. None of them are unique to Morocco, but nonetheless, they remain a barrier to serious progress. There's a race against the clock, but moving too fast, on the other hand, could destabilize the entire system and even roll back the reform process. And in talking to all these people, you can really feel that the country is changing. People are speaking out openly. People are expressing their ideas freely, without fear, without any sense that somebody's listening or watching. And that really struck us. But at the same time, there's also a sense of uncertainty that we could pick up, that people weren't exactly sure where the reform process was leading, that this was still very much a work in progress. As the debate goes on within these different competing layers of society, between these different interest groups, it's very clear that the king is leading this process. And so far, as I mentioned, he has been a very effective manager of the process. He's created stability while making political and economic change, and that's extremely important. He's demonstrated his commitment by promoting a number of reforms, as Robin earlier mentioned, strengthening of women's rights, launching a state commission of inquiry or truth commission to examine past abuses by the state, which I think is really groundbreaking in the Arab world. And he's expanded space for political participation, mainly among Islamists, which have been the main benefactor of this open space. But this is both a positive and a negative trend. On the one hand, the king has been a stabilizer, an effective manager. On the other hand, there's the risk that too much of this top-down approach will marginalize other voices within society. And the use of royal decrees to promote legislation, the control of unelected officials, could actually undermine the reform process in Morocco. This is something that's hotly debated. The role of the king as the manager of this process is hotly debated in Morocco. And the issue of authority and power is something that people differ on. Some people would like to see the status quo. Some people would like to see more powers and decision-making devolving to other institutions within the government, namely the cabinet, the parliament, etc. So I think the real test of the reform process in Morocco will be for the monarchy to take a lower profile in driving the reform process and allowing groups and forces beyond the control of the palace to play a more active role in decision-making and in driving the reforms. With all of this, bringing it back to the U.S. and Europe, Morocco's commitment and the progress it's made has really caught the attention of the U.S. and Europe, which want Morocco to succeed in many ways and make it a model for reform in the region. The U.S. and Europe have obviously had long and historical positive ties with Morocco. Since the Cold War, Morocco is a founding member of the European Mediterranean, the Barcelona process and the ENP. It has association agreement with Europe. It has an FTA, free trade agreement with the United States. It's a benefactor of U.S. and European aid on many different levels. So I think this is important, but what we have to understand is that, as Robin also mentioned, that there's vastly different strategies of how to promote reform between the U.S. and Europe. Europe often stresses tangible projects like highway construction, slum clearance, while the U.S. is focused more on capacity building and more abstract ideas of strengthening individual rights. And again, I think there's a debate within Morocco and within the community that's promoting political reform over the role of the international community in Morocco's reform process. I remember not long ago, the head of the Moroccan Journalists Association declared his open opposition to the broader Middle East and North Africa initiative, claiming that he wouldn't work with the United States in any of the reform projects that they were undertaking. So there is this debate about the role of the international community in Morocco. And just to sum up, I think this is both a blessing and a curse for Morocco. On the one hand, Morocco derives benefit from U.S. aid, from European aid and attention, and this partnership that the U.S. and Europe are trying to build. But on the other hand, it's also put Morocco under a microscope. Everything that Morocco does is being scrutinized by the international community. And so, again, I think this is both positive and negative for Morocco. The international community is holding Morocco to very high standards, and I think a lot of people are expecting serious reform in Morocco. I think Moroccans are also expecting serious progress. And I think our project was also very much part of this international microscope examining and scrutinizing Morocco's efforts. There is definitely a role for the international community, an important role, in working with Morocco to ensure that Morocco's reforms are not merely a change in style, but a fundamental change in governance and power. And as I said, this is very much a work in progress. But what I think we all need to realize, and I'll leave it at that, is that this ultimately must be a Moroccan process, led and driven by Moroccans, based on Moroccan needs and interests. Thank you. John?
Thank you. I thought that it would be helpful to give you a sense for what our conclusions were, and it's perhaps symptomatic of all of this that we came looking at three major questions and ended up with seven major conclusions. I think it gives you a sense for how much interesting stuff is going on in Morocco. I think the three questions that sort of animated this whole exercise from the start were, one, what are the most important components of a reform process in a Middle Eastern country? I mean, everybody's talking about reform, but when you actually talk about what are the engines, what are the conditions, what are the sorts of things you really need to promote, let's look at Morocco, let's look at a real case and figure out what those elements are. Second, what's the optimal relationship between a host government and donor governments? I mean, there are lots of different countries that have relationships with Morocco as donors, and you also have the EU, and you have the G8. I mean, there seem to be a lot of opportunities to look at the way these relationships work. Morocco seemed to be a remarkable case study for that. And then the third issue is the issue of transatlantic consensus. How important is transatlantic consensus? Do we want cooperation on everything? Do we want cooperation on some things? Should we seek something else? So we went with this very interesting international group, half Americans and half Europeans, to look at these questions. We came up with, I think, seven very important kinds of conclusions. The first is what we saw in Morocco underlined the importance of government leadership. You can't stress it enough. The Moroccan monarchy, without question, is the key driver of reform in Morocco. Now, that's a good thing and a bad thing, as Chaim alluded to. I mean, on the one hand, it's great to have leadership that's leading. But on the other hand, you have to make sure that there are also forces coming up from below. Because if you don't have those forces filling the space, then it's not going to be sustaining. It's not going to continue on. The fact is that you want leadership, but you want the right amount of leadership, because too much leadership will then mean that true reform never really takes root in the society. So there's sort of an appreciation for government leadership, but a caveat for government leadership, that you want the right amount, which is probably never going to be as much as you'd like. But if it's as much as you like, it might not actually work. In the Moroccan case in particular, it seems that the key hurdle in front of the government is how to peel off being a supporter of reform and letting go of control over a reform process, which ultimately could be very, very perilous, right? Because one of the parts of reform is ending subsidies and protections for people. It plays with the structure of power in a country, and people could be hurt. And at the same time, if you're not intervening and you're creating a process whereby people resolve disputes in the society, that can be very destabilizing. So the question then becomes how you move that. The test for the government will be how they step away from really driving this process to guiding the process and then ultimately standing and watching the process go as it moves forward on its own. Second issue. There's a debate in the literature about whether you want to have economic reform that leads to political reform or whether you want to do political reform that then leads to economic reform. And certainly the intertwined nature of economics and politics in the Middle East suggests that at some point you have to think about what the relationship between these two orientations is. There are a number of countries which have said, we're going to do the economics first, and then we'll create a stable middle class, and they will push for political reform. And the U.S. in some cases has been very supportive of that. Certainly Europe, looking at their Eastern European example, said that's a great model because look at what happened in Poland and Central Europe and other places. I think Morocco ends up being a very interesting sign that actually you can do the two together, that you can integrate them, you can have them actually be mutually reinforcing. And Morocco has been trying to do the two at once, opening up politics, opening up economics, and having the two intertwine. And the trick here, going back to the earlier point, is that when you start cutting subsidies, when you start hurting people, you have to be able to persuade them that this is actually all in the national interest. And at this point, the Moroccan government has done a very, very good job persuading people that the changes that they are seeing are actually constructive and are leading to a better future. Third point. Morocco has integrated Islamists into the political process, I think much more successfully thus far than most of its neighbors. There's a tendency in many countries in the Middle East to say anybody with a religious foundation to their political party can't take part in politics. We've seen in Egypt, we've seen in other countries. Morocco has, through its incorporation of the PJD into politics, has demonstrated, I think, that you can work with Islamists. Islamists will play by the rules, and it can create a more inclusive set of electoral politics. There are elections coming up next year. Certainly, people are going to be watching them closely. They are not in any means out of the woods, but up to now, the Moroccan experience bringing Islamists into politics has been a model of political inclusion for the region. Third point, and this I think sort of surprised us a little bit, but we said, you know, kings have a real advantage in making this stuff work. And coming from a democracy which got rid of kings 200, I don't know how many years ago, I don't do math when I'm speaking extemporaneously. We got rid of our king, but the fact is that having a king guide this stuff actually helps in a lot of ways because the king doesn't have to be engaged in the day-to-day politics. The king doesn't have to always be popular. The king can be above politics and can mediate politics and can persuade people for non-political reasons that they should do things in a way that people competing every 1 year, 2 years, 3 years for votes can't do. So here is a case where actually being less democratic in name, because a lot of the republics in the Middle East aren't very democratic at all, but being less democratic in name actually gives advantages because it gives Morocco a sort of lubricant for making the hard choices that other countries don't necessarily have. Fifth point. I think Morocco demonstrates that outside powers can play a useful role in promoting reform, but they can't force it. The key drivers of the reform process in Morocco have been almost entirely internal. This is something which makes sense for Moroccans, for Morocco. It's not something that the outside world implored the Moroccans to do. And I think as a consequence, the Moroccans have been able to label reform as something that is genuinely national, not something that's imported. And that's something that other Middle Eastern countries, I think, have been behind the curve on. That the Moroccan government has taken ownership of the reform idea, and the idea then doesn't seem like it's imposed from Washington or Paris or some other foreign capital. Six, I think Morocco's experience has demonstrated that there's a lot of wisdom in what Europeans like to do, which is mostly top-down infrastructure reform, and what Americans like to do, which is bottom-up capacity building kinds of reform. And there's wisdom in both approaches, and there's actually a certain complementarity in the two approaches. And there's a remarkable diversity. We met with with a whole array of ambassadors and others from different countries working in Morocco, and the different strategies. Everybody really does have a different strategy. The EU has its own strategy. Different countries have their own strategy. The U.S. has its own strategy. And there's a certain complementarity to the fact that Americans really are all about decentralization and pushing stuff out into the countryside and regional centers, and a European approach that's really about building things that make a difference. And it seems to me that the two fit together well. And the seventh issue is this issue of the U.S.-European part. And here I think is one of the things that probably promoted the most sustained debate through our week together. And I think where we came down is that for the most part, what the U.S. and Europe should look to do is coordinate more than cooperate. What does that mean? I think it means that we should have open channels of communication. We should divide tasks. We should know what the other one's doing. But the fact is that when it comes to actually getting stuff done on the ground, we differ so profoundly about how to do it that we end up complicating things. That there's a lot of coordination that's very helpful, and some of it's really informal. I mean, some of it's between the people working on electoral politics from different foundations, working with different parties. And in that case, just meetings to say, we're doing this sort of thing. These are the kinds of groups we're working with. Helps avoid duplication in a way that also gives individual countries the ability to both do things that are in the political interest of their voting blocs, but also not to do things that are politically beyond the pale. I mean, certainly there are different red lines in Europe than there are in the United States. And having this coordination means that the U.S. can do what it can do, and Europeans can do what they can do, and I think you end up with a much stronger and complementary system. I think what's different then is when do you want to actually do cooperation? Because coordination, transparency, and all those things are important, but sometimes you really want to do cooperation, and it seems to me that the times you want to do cooperation are where you're trying to pressure a government. You're either trying to reward good behavior or punish bad behavior. And here's a time when you really do want common agendas, you do want common parameters, because it keeps the incentive structure clean and it keeps people from breaking down the incentive structure, right? Because if all the donors are on the same page for what they really want and what they don't want in very, very specific instances, then you enhance the possibility of compliance. The kinds of issues that lend themselves to international cooperation, in our judgment, are basic guidelines for political participation, discrete economic reform measures, and trade agreements. And those are the kinds of issues that they tend to be clean issues. The issues where conditionality in general, and I think broader cooperation more particularly, won't work, are the kinds of issues like political freedom. I mean, you can go around and around and around in circles trying to define it, trying to measure it, trying to judge it. You can't make somebody do something if it's not really clear what the conditions are, how you judge that they've been met, and how to move forward. But certainly the cleaner those issues are, the more possible it is to use conditionality, and in these cases, a broader international consensus behind conditionality is useful. I think we all left thinking Morocco is important, thinking Morocco is promising, but thinking that success surely isn't assured in Morocco. There are storm clouds on the horizon. Job growth is a consistent problem. There are slums that fill with poor youth from the countryside. People can't get jobs. The threat of terrorism is a deep concern. Morocco is moving swiftly, but I think only time will tell if it's moving either too swiftly or not swiftly enough. The key challenge, as I suggested, was how do you balance leadership from above with encouraging demands from below? There is not yet broad public enthusiasm that we saw for the reform process. I mean, there's interest, there's curiosity, but you don't really see people taking ownership. You don't see people with a kind of deep faith in the reform process that, that we will perhaps see in coming years. Reforms have begun to touch people's lives, but it seems to me that more work needs to be done to reach not only into poor neighborhoods, but into other regions of the country and make reform relevant. Creating public enthusiasm for reform also creates public pressure, and that's a danger or potential danger for the government of Morocco as it moves forward. There's not a risk-free option here. There simply isn't a risk-free option. But it's our sense that the government of Morocco is doing a very, very constructive and clear-minded job moving forward on all these issues. In all this, the European countries and the U.S. have been playing a helpful role, and it seems to us that through better communication, both among themselves and with the Moroccan government, their effectiveness can increase. Morocco is a laboratory for efforts to create healthy societies in the Middle East and North Africa, and they've devoted billions of dollars and euros during the last half century toward its attainment, often with paltry results. And as Chaim said, the key issue is this, that Moroccans understand more than anybody that the responsibility for success or failure is theirs. We can play a constructive role. I think we will play a constructive role, but ultimately this is up to Morocco. Thank you. We're happy to take questions about the book, about Morocco, about what it's like traveling with a dozen people. Yeah. Can you wait for the microphone if you would? Thanks.
Tim Resch, I'm with Friends of Morocco. Your chapter on external support to the reform process kind of talks about the USAID, FTA, spigots. I was wondering what you thought about the perhaps the drivers of those spigots, lobbyists, Moroccan embassy here in the United States, the Moroccan diaspora, civil society, Congress, which helps to shape perhaps the kind of the U.S. response or how the U.S. helps Morocco is more than, if you will, administration programs and what that mix is and how civil society and think tanks can contribute to the process.
That's a political question. I'll let you
know. It's a political question. I mean, in my judgment, Morocco has successfully gotten onto the list of countries that matter, but it's not one of the sort of strategic balance countries. I mean, it's not a country like Egypt. We have a $2.1 billion aid relationship. It's totally tied into the way the U.S. thinks of itself in the Middle East. Morocco's not in that category. I think it's constructive that Morocco's not in that category, but in the next category of countries where it's important, but probably not vital, I think Morocco is at the top of that list when it comes to the Middle East. We've been running, I think, a very interesting Maghreb roundtable that's looked at a whole range of issues in Morocco for the last year. I have been not only consistently interested, but surprised at the amount of richness that there is in the issues. I know Abdeslam Mehrawi has been doing some issues related to Morocco and Moroccan politics. I think there's growing interest in Morocco, and it seems to me that all of that and the presence of all of you today is a sign that there's growing curiosity. I think Washington's a great town for information. And to the extent that people are learning more, people are aware of the complexities, and people perceive the opportunities, I think that's one of Washington's amazing strengths. There wasn't a lot of work going on in Morocco 5 years ago. There's a lot more now, and I think that's one of the neat things. You know, one of the sort of strange aside is I was in China about 18 months ago talking to Middle East experts, and one of them said, you know, the best place in the world if you really, really, really want to understand the Middle East is Washington, D.C. Right? All my Arab friends, they turn white when I describe this. But, you know, but their perception is with all the stuff that's on the internet and all the discussions and all the information that comes out of here, Washington really is an amazing font of knowledge. And I think that Morocco has been getting more and more attention is constructive both for the United States and ultimately constructive for Morocco.
Hi, I'm Martha Dye with Transparency International, and I actually was recently in Morocco working on a U.S.-funded reform-related program, not with transparency, but in another capacity. And we've had some successes, and we had some challenges, and some of the challenges were related to anti-Americanism, and some of them were related to difficulties with the relationship with the government. And so I'm wondering, from your research, what kinds of reform programs, what kinds of modalities of engagement do you think are likely to be feasible, workable, and successful in Morocco from the sort of U.S.-based bottom-up approach?
In my deep, dark past, I wrote a book about Egypt and American foreign assistance in the 50s, which is still in print. And you know, which looked at us when we were first getting into the aid business in the 1950s, and the Egyptians had just gotten rid of the monarchy, and were thinking about how quickly the country could change and become prosperous. It seems to me there's a basic problem with capacity building aid relationships, in that we expect really quick results, they expect really quick results, and the results aren't so quick. That's not to say that we don't build capacity. And I think that over time, we do build tremendous capacity. But it seems to me that there's a desire for metrics for specific projects of 1 year, 2 year duration, which I think are often hard to meet. You have this sort of trying to think of what... But they, when they talk about evolution, and they talk about the sort of episodic disequilibriums, I mean, you have these sort of leaps forward where you have a cadre of people who can change an institution. And I think it takes that steady investment to get the group of people who come together and can move things forward. But, you know, the problem of outside donors trying to change the way things work is not specific to Morocco. It's not specific to the Middle East. It's a problem that we keep working on. And it seems to me that ultimately the way you have to judge this is in generational terms, even though you pay for it out of annual budgets. So, Ariel?
Ariel, the Heritage Foundation.
Can you wait for the microphone?
I don't want to... embarrass Chaim, so it's a political question. I'll direct it to you, but if Chaim wants to
jump in,
please. How do you think the lessons from Morocco are influencing the discussion and the debate in Washington, specifically in the administration, about how much we need to emphasize the so-called democracy promotion versus our real interests, strategy, economic development, in some places oil, and things like that. And I don't think Morocco was a focus of pressure of the U.S. foreign policy like some other places to democratize at the neck-breaking speed. But how did that affect them, and what was their reaction to the priorities of 6 to 12 months ago?
I think the U.S. has always been trying to balance its interests in the region. Morocco is no different. Strategic interest, democratization. In many ways, democratization became a strategic interest of the Bush administration. So it fits in with that ideal. I'll take this question anyway, Ariel, even though it is political. But there are certain lessons that we can draw from Morocco, as John mentioned. The U.S. has been active in Morocco for probably close to 50 years. This is not a new beginning for U.S. engagement with Morocco. USAID has been active. There have been many, many contacts throughout the years. More smaller, more modest efforts to promote freedom of speech, freedom of the press, et cetera. So I don't think this is entirely new. This is something that's been going on. The urgency is growing for the U.S. and the region. The urgency is growing for Europe and the region as well, and for Morocco. But I don't think this is a new necessarily twist. I think it's a different focus, a different strategy perhaps, but part of an ongoing effort.
I think that's right, that the president really believes this is strategic. The president, I think, and I mean, I'm told, though I haven't discussed it with him, I'm told Elliot Abrams is very keen on the Moroccan experiment being successful, not for political reasons, but for strategic ones. I couldn't help but note that the president talked about democracy in the Arab world on September 11th. He talked about it in front of the UN General Assembly. I don't think the president is fleeting in his interest in this. And I think he sees it as the overwhelming strategic interest of the United States in the Middle East. Morocco's experience, I think, has not caught on the way many in the administration would have hoped throughout the rest of the Middle East. There's a way in which Morocco, being at one edge of the Arab world, doesn't always factor in. But it seems to me that there are lessons from Morocco that are worth drawing for other countries in the Mashrek, in the Eastern Arab world, in Levant, and into the Gulf. And I think over time, with continued success, others will look more and more to Morocco. You know, one of the other things that's, I think, very different about Morocco is you don't have a country that's basically given away money. I mean, this isn't a country with huge extractive industries, and therefore it works differently than many of the other monarchies in the Arab world. And as I said, there's a way in which monarchies help you, and for some of these republics, it can be a little harder for a president to do the kinds of things that King Mohammed VI have done. Yes.
Adam Garfinkel of the American Interest magazine. I was listening to you talk about the U.S. and the EU and, of course, the Moroccans. And the question that comes to my mind is, what is the definition of success in a reform process? And I could easily make the argument that there are three different definitions of success, the internal one in Morocco, the U.S. definition, and a European definition. And if the definitions are not just different but sort of contradictory or don't fit right together, what does that imply about where all this is liable to lead?
It seems to me that there's actually part of what we've been doing is trying to come to greater consensus on what it is we're trying to do. We're going to have some differences, but I think broadly we're actually converging more on what we hope Morocco to look like, how we hope Morocco will work. And a lot of this is ultimately in terms of dynamics rather than in terms of sort of things you can check off a list. But, you know, it's like parenting. You know, the job's never done. And you never know how well you're doing. And sometimes you think you're on top of the game and sometimes you're not. But
Can I push you just a little bit? I
mean, sure. And you will anyway.
One can imagine a sort of a maximalist definition of success whereby at some future date Morocco stops being a real monarchy and becomes a democracy, as European, either a parliamentary democracy or a presidential democracy, as Westerners understand it. Right? I don't know that anybody in Morocco, or at least anybody in the government, thinks of that as an ideal endpoint for where this reform process culminates. Or am I wrong about that?
I mean, there are different views about what the role of the king should be, from he should be out of here to he should stay the king. There are lots of European... I mean, I was in Sweden. I had no idea until I was in Sweden that they actually had a king, you know? Which shows how you can be surprised or how little I know about Europe. I'm not sure that has to be the crucial guide is the role of the king. It seems to me that the real issue, and this comes to the capacity building issue, The real issue is an institutional one. And the real issue is having dynamic institutions that are separate from the monarchy. And that is not an easy thing to do. But it seems to me that that's the direction broadly where Morocco is headed. That's the direction broadly where the U.S. would like Morocco to head. And that's the direction where broadly Europe would like Morocco to head. It's not going to happen, you know, this year. But it seems to me that, that actually, if that's what we're looking for, which is dynamic institutions which are responsive to the public and help determine priorities for change, that we're not there, but we're relatively united on wanting to get there, both all the U.S., Europe, and Morocco. You want to add to that?
I think you said it. I mean, we can't necessarily expect Morocco or any other country in the region to move on our timetable and in our image. This is a Moroccan process, and they must decide what the future of the monarchy will be. They have to decide what powers would be devolved to the parliament, to a government, who should appoint the prime minister. All of those issues are not necessarily concepts or formulations that we would like to see happen.
I mean, that being said, we can all work out our own checklists, and we can all keep score in different ways. But I think that, in terms of the goals, I think we broadly see the goals in the same way. We just might keep score a little differently. So, Howard Malcolm. Howard.
Howard LaFranchi with the Christian Science Monitor. John, you mentioned the lack of public enthusiasm for the reform and the process in different aspects of reform. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that or what you think might explain that, what elements might be. It seems to me it's important to understand that at a time when we're putting so much stock in Middle East reform.
There's an expression in Arabic, siyasa laha nasa, right, that politics has its own people. And there's a sense among a lot of people that this doesn't really represent a fundamental change. I think the Moroccan government is serious about persuading people that this is a fundamental change. It's not just about rearranging the furniture. It's about changing the dynamics of the way things work. Ultimately, the proof of that pudding is in the eating. And if Moroccans feel that, that there are different processes, different avenues to the redress of grievances, different ways to get priorities addressed by the government, then it will build greater enthusiasm for participation in that process. That's, you know, it's a process of testing that's involved, and it requires people to have success when they try to use some of these new avenues of influence. That process has been moving, but it's certainly not complete, and I think many Moroccans are adopting a wait-and-see attitude. But, you know, what's interesting, and I don't mean to use the cab driver, you know, way of analyzing politics, but I have had Moroccan cab drivers here in Washington. And you talk to Moroccans, and, you know, it's sort of gotten their attention. There's a sense that there's a possibility that wasn't there before. And people have identified it as something to pay attention to. So in terms of seizing people's attention, I think that has gone on. Building enthusiasm is something else. You know, as all the political activists in Washington can tell you, that's a hard process. But I think that there is this broad sense of curiosity and possibility that people just haven't quite bought into but are very interested in.
I'll just add that there are certain groups within Moroccan society that maybe haven't been touched by reform as much as other urbanites, people living in cities, the elite. Morocco still remains a very rural society in some places, and there have been efforts to decentralize power through the INDH plan, which is seeking to deliver funds directly to local communities, allow local communities to invest without the burden of the central government. But this is still the beginning of that process. There hasn't been really any time to gauge the effectiveness of that sort of decentralization. The issue of freedom of the press is another important aspect where the press laws have been changed. The media is breaking all of the taboos in Morocco. They're writing about any issue they want to, about the king, about the Western Sahara, et cetera. Yet the high level of illiteracy, almost 50% in some places, doesn't allow people to really take advantage of those freedoms of the press or of expanded publications and in print and other media. So, again, there are different levels, I think, of people and society that are being affected by the reforms, and I think that is going to affect public enthusiasm as we look at this process down the road.
Andrew Maslowski with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. With all of the talk that we've been hearing about how the king is really a driver for reform, I'd be curious to hear if the authors would elaborate a bit more on what they see as his motivations, rather than just accepting as an a priori fact that, yes, this king is reform-minded and wants to see this change. I think if you take the case of, for instance, Yemen, as another country where we've seen a great deal of reform taking place recently, there seems to be a consensus, though, that has taken place because they're waiting for money from the Millennium Challenge account, and that's a good motivator. But I'm curious as to hear your opinions on what is actually motivating the king in Morocco's case.
I think the king is genuinely committed to modernizing his country, to expanding individual rights for his country. I mean, Morocco, like other countries in the region, is facing a growing threat of terrorism. There were the Casablanca bombings in May 2003, growing unemployment, growing sense of alienation, marginalization among the youth. A lot of people are trying to leave Morocco to gain employment in Europe. There are a lot of socioeconomic challenges that Morocco faces. And I think even before Mohammed VI ascended the throne, the late Hassan II realized that things needed to change in Morocco, that there was a need for freedom of expression, more political participation, a more inclusive system. And he gradually started the process of liberalization, which Mohammed VI picked up and inherited and really has started to run with. It was Hassan II that brought in the socialist opposition forces. It was Hassan II that allowed the PJD party, the Islamist party, to participate in the elections. Now, many people could argue that this was a case of tactical liberalization, as Dan Brumberg has elaborated on. But at the same time, I think there is a growing understanding that Morocco needs to change, not because of the U.S. and Europe want Morocco to change, not because the outside world wants Morocco to change, but because if Morocco is to remain a stable and secure country that can provide for its people in the new century, that fundamental changes in governance and society are going to have to be enacted.
There's also a generational aspect to all of this. And, I mean, if you look across the Middle East, you find that young leaders really have no faith in the utility of censorship. They're much more willing to have more open debates. I mean, Bashar al-Assad, the exception. But for the most part, I think younger leaders say the old systems don't work. And what we've seen in Morocco is somebody who says, you got to make it interesting. And I think that plays some role. Psychologically, how do you get on somebody's intellectual radar screen? I don't know. All sorts of other issues. It's right here.
Hi, Lila Foss with the Trade and Development Agency. I know that your study's focused on bilateral assistance with Morocco, but I was curious how multilateral assistance impacts the reform efforts, particularly with the World Bank and the UN, and if you delved into that at all.
We did some. I think where that comes down is on the conditionality. I'm sure you're more familiar with the conditionality literature than I am, but certainly what we saw in Morocco bore that out, that this sort of broad stuff about political freedom, what a miserable indicator political freedom is, because nobody can define it. It's just too messy and too big. But certainly, I think we caught a number of hints that on very discrete issues, when there's broad donor coordination of goals and benchmarks, that it's easier to, if you know what the target is, and you know what the reward for the target is, and the fuzzier all that gets, then the harder it is for that process to yield the kind of change that the donors want. So the more discrete both the goal and the reward are, the more likely you are to get compliance. But that's, I mean, that reinforces what we learned from the literature. It doesn't, I don't think it's a blazing new insight. So, is there a question back here?
Hi, Melanie Bixby, House International Relations Committee. The gentleman over there raised the issue of the Millennium Challenge account, and my colleague and I from the committee traveled to Mongolia in August to look at the development of the compact. I was curious as to whether you heard about the compact from any non-governmental types that you interviewed, including the private sector and civil society, and also did you look at the likely increasing U.S. influence given that our program will possibly go from between 40 and 50 million total for everything, security assistance and everything, to perhaps $750 million. This will put us, the ambassador estimates, between, right after Spain and France, maybe even equal with France. And this program has conditionality inherent in it, not only to become eligible, but to remain eligible. The MCC does use international indices to measure eligibility, and they do have specific benchmarks for that program, including for political. So if, I was wondering if you had taken a look at that or if you, anybody was able to share that with you.
I don't think the Millennium Challenge account came up in detail in our discussions in Morocco. People were aware that Morocco was trying to negotiate a compact, and we've heard that the compact would be for a sizable amount, which would greatly increase the U.S. assistance program to Morocco. But in terms of the effects of that assistance, we didn't delve too deeply into that. John, do you have anything to add?
It seems to me a little bit abstract because we saw the ambassador, and he spoke to us with a group of others, and he wasn't really able to articulate exactly what an MCC-like program would look like in comparison to all the other countries. It seemed to us that there was a distinctly American approach to all of this that was quite different from what the Canadians did, quite different from what the Brits did, and, I mean, certainly different from what the French did. But I think at this, certainly when we were there, you know, 9 months ago, there wasn't a sense for what the menu of MCC-like initiatives would look like and how they'd be implemented on the ground. Well, certainly at that point, it was watch that space. Whether it's still watch that space, I think I have to go back, which I'm happy to do.
Mohammed Al-Minshawi from Tahrir, Washington. Do you think the United States and the EU as major donors should use the unique Moroccan experience of including Islamists in the political reform process to pursue, to convince other Arab countries, mainly Egypt and Algeria, to include their Islamists in the political reform as well?
My bias in this, which is my bias, is you can't be serious about political reform if you a priori exclude a large part of the electorate. Now, you can exclude some part of the Islamists. You can exclude people who don't buy in to a political process. But it seems to me that if you're creating a political process, it has to be one that starts by inclusion rather than starts a priori by exclusion. I know there's a debate in Egypt about whether to include the Ikhwan formally in the political process. Again, on a personal level, it's never made sense to me that Egyptian law precludes religious parties from running, because all you have to do is talk to Egyptians and you realize that for some sizable, not a majority, but some sizable percentage of the population, they actually do think that religion should have something to say about how the society runs. You also have this in the United States. And I think a priori excluding them gets you off on the wrong foot for a broader process, which ultimately is about using inclusion to manage difference. And I think starting by hacking off 30% of the electorate is not a promising first step.
I think so far the U.S. sees Morocco's experience with integrating Islamists as a positive development. I mean, certainly before the Palestinian elections, parliamentary elections, the U.S. President Bush agreed to sanction basically Palestinian elections with the inclusion of Hamas. There was some pressure on Egypt before the parliamentary elections last November to allow greater space for independent candidates affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood to participate. So I think this could be a growing trend within U.S. policy. There are other countries in the region also adopting a similar tactic. Algeria is also experimenting now with integrating some Islamists, including former forces of the FIS. So I think this is a growing trend in the region, and I think the U.S. is very interested in the Moroccan example of how this is going to play out. And a major test case of this, or a major test and benchmark, is going to be the parliamentary elections in Morocco next year.
Dan.
Yes, Dan.
Wait for the microphone.
George, I'm U.S. the Chief University of the USIP. Thanks. I'm John for very interesting presentations. I also want to say, as a member of the study group, that we had a grand time. And that if you want to send us back to any country in the region, we're ready to go back. At least I'm speaking for myself and quite a few other members of the study group. It really
I want to take some countries off that list. Anyway.
Oh, I think the next one is Algeria, right? But it really was an excellent group, and I think it was an extremely useful experience and a very interesting one. I want to take up a question, Billy, on the most recent question about the Islamists and the upcoming elections. We met with two groups of Islamists when we were in Rabat. We met with Justice and Development, and we met with Justice and Charity. We certainly had the sense, having met with both groups, that one is for working within the status quo, and the other one clearly rejects the status quo. One can understand why it's a member of the political process right now. On the other hand, we didn't, I think, get a sense of really what the basis of support was for the Justice and Development Party. And it has a liberal kind of modernist view from the top. It was very hard for us to sense what the objectives were of the mass base of this party, or in fact whether it had a mass base at all. To what extent was it a co-opted party? To what extent was it an independent party? And I think some of the questions might be answered in the upcoming elections. I ask this question in part because when we were in Morocco, we heard a lot from the Justice and Development Party people saying, well, we've been to Turkey, and we saw the Turkish variety, and that's what we aspire to. But a lot of the news coming out of Turkey now about the Justice and Development Party in Turkey and what they're doing is somewhat disquieting, to say the least. And this notion of a Muslim democratic alternative, as much as many of us would like to see it come to fruition, is still an open question, even in places such as Turkey, where we're often told it's easier for to have this sort of alternative emerge and get institutionalized. What, from what you saw and what you've read about Morocco, do you think would be the upshot of the Justice and Development Party winning, let's say, 60% of the seats, or 55 or 60% of the seats, or half the seats in the parliament? Would it be a party that would share power out of strategic commitment, or would it be simply compelled to do so because of the array of interests that are in the system, particularly that of the monarch? This is asking you to speculate. I know this is a tricky question, but ultimately this is where the answer will lie, right? What this party will do, what its membership is all about. I think these are questions that just began to skim the surface on.
Thank you. It seems to me that the immediate impulse will be to share power. I'm not sure what the percentage they'll get in the vote will be, but my sense of the way Moroccan politics are set up, and this is partly the role of the monarchy vis-a-vis political parties as well, that there's a fairly strong incentive to share power and work within the system if you're going to play the political game at all. So I don't expect it to be a huge upheaval in the way Morocco works. I think that the partly in response to your question, partly to get back to Mohammed's question, I think the key disturbing aspect of Islamic political participation is the element of coercion that we see in many Islamic parties in terms of forcing separation of the sexes and forcing other sorts of things. And it seems to me that part of this needs to be putting safeguards in the system that protect individual rights, protecting the right, for instance, to be secular. And that, I think, is going to be the challenge as systems move toward an evolution of inclusion. The other part of this has to be putting in firm safeguards that allow for inclusion of people who may not agree with whether it's a strong minority, a plurality, a majority, but protecting individual rights. And that's one of the reasons why having a process that leads to this is advantageous, because it seems to me that the dangerous part of this is not that you have governments which are somewhat less supportive of U.S. foreign policy. The danger is you have governments which systematically ride roughshod over individual rights and individual decision-making about how they feel about God.
Let me a quick follow-up question on this, John. Other than the monarch, what is the safeguard in the monarchy? What is the safeguard in Morocco? Our strong sense was that the Istiklal Party and the Socialist Party had lost huge support. So when you ask yourself what the safeguards will be, will it be a contrived outcome in the election such that the outcome is somehow predetermined, boiled in advance of the whole process, so that we make sure that the safeguards are in place, in which case the whole legitimacy of the operation will be up for grabs. What are the safeguards?
The safeguards for the 2007 election is the monarchy, right?
Yes.
But more broadly, I think you have to talk about a range of mediating institutions. People complain about gridlock in Washington, but gridlock in Washington ends up being constructive, right? Because it means there are lots of mediating institutions that bring in lots of different interest groups, and that all gets conflicted or deconflicted as it is, and the government and country move incrementally in one way or the other. It seems to me that that's what Morocco needs. And you can say, well, the last thing Morocco needs is more governmental gridlock, but the fact is that it needs the monarchy to be pushing and the monarchy to be restrained and other people to be pushing the monarchy and pulling against the monarchy. And it seems to me that that is a process which is not a one-year process, not a two-year process. It's a process of decades. And Morocco seems to be moving in that general direction. The question, then is one of how do you begin to peel off the restraints? I mean, it's like taking off the training wheels, and how do you move that process so it continues to move forward, stays on track, and leads to these other mediating institutions. And that's a challenge. It's not a challenge that's unique to Morocco, and that's one of the reasons Morocco, I think, is an interesting case study for other countries, because if they can pull that off, that does become a remarkable model for the rest of the region. But it seems to me that, increasingly the way I see it, and I think the Morocco trip influenced this, increasingly I see this as the need for a multiplicity of strong institutions, which is what you don't see in most countries in the Middle East. In most places, it's only the presidency. So I think we have time for one last question. George.
George Pickart with CMS Energy. Both of you sort of left an impression in your remarks that there's a fairly significant and unmet challenge for reform in Morocco. And perhaps that's true on the political side, but I wonder if maybe you would identify what you see as the major deficiencies remaining in the Moroccan economy. I guess it's my observation that they have undertaken some fairly significant reforms, and if you look at the particular example of the FTA, that they've really opened themselves up to some real challenges, particularly in the potential disruption of the agricultural sector. So it seems to me maybe then that the challenge might not be so much kind of vaulting ahead to the next generation of reforms as consolidating what's already been undertaken, particularly in the area, John, that you mentioned at the end of your remarks on the creation of jobs and economic prosperity. So I wonder if you'd comment on that.
I think there are several, if I may, major challenges to Morocco. As you mentioned, one is the agriculture. Morocco is very dependent on agriculture for its economy. GDP in Morocco fluctuates by up to 7% based on the annual rainfall, and that's a real problem for people, especially as more and more people are moving to the cities. Another major issue is privatization. The economic liberalization that has happened so far has left, as it has in many other countries, has left a lot of the former state-owned industries in the hands of an elite group around the palace, which continue to benefit from their political ties with the monarchy. And I think there's a real need, just as there's a need for competition and in the ideas sphere, there's a need for greater competition in the economic sphere, and that's something that Morocco, I think, needs to work on in terms of spreading the wealth of liberalization and privatization. The other issue that Morocco faces is major competition now. The textile industry in Morocco has been devastated. In the last year, the exports of textiles, which is a major major industry for Morocco, was down by close to 30% because of multi-fiber trade arrangements and the WTO. So there are a number of issues. Morocco needs to diversify its economy more. I think these are all issues that we've seen in other cases, but are of particular concern with such a high unemployment rate in Morocco and the number of people that are trying to migrate from Morocco and seek employment outside of Morocco.
But I think, as you point out, a lot of the indicators are moving in the right direction. But I think what we're suggesting as well is that Morocco is moving partly under the force of challenges coming from a diverse set of directions, and that's why this issue of international engagement to try to move Morocco, to try to direct Morocco, to try to get Morocco to do the kinds of things, to invest in the kinds of things, to invest in the kinds of people, is so important. I think ultimately it's the stake that everybody feels in the success of this, not just the monarchy, not just European governments, not just the U.S. governments, that makes this Moroccan partnership so interesting and ultimately so important, not just for Morocco, but for how we think about change and progress in the Middle East more broadly. I really appreciate everybody coming out today. I hope you enjoy reading the book. If you have more questions or comments, please don't hesitate to get in contact with us. We're all too findable, and we look forward to continuing the discussion. Thank you.